Hello and welcome to another week of Media Talk. This week, super injunctions and sports stars. Does John Terry have a right to a private life off the pitch? Trust the Tories. Will a new Conservative government force a change at the top of the BBC? Plus, the digital drop, radio listening figures are out, and they're not good news for the switchover plans. I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, Jane Martinson, the editor of Media Guardian, has got the Guardian Mega Awards judging under her belt. But I guess, Jane, it's probably too late for Katie Price to enter for most shameless PR stunt of the week.
It is. She can just keep that for another year. Because obviously there'll be a lot more PR stunts with the Katie and Katie and Peter show.
Stephen Brook is the deputy editor of MediaGuardian.co.uk. Did Kay Burley make you cry this week?
Oh, when she threw to the ad break after terrorising poor old Peter Andre with those hard, flinty eyes, I didn't cry, I got a chill.
Great. On to our top story first, with the top man in the English football team. At the time of podding, John Terry's position as England captain was looking decidedly shaky. It all started with another one of those super injunctions, obtained this time by London libel law specialist Shillings. It was only when the injunction was lifted, after pressure by, amongst other papers, The Guardian, it was revealed that John Terry had sought it to prevent tabloid revelations about his private life. Now, Stephen, the last time we talked about super injunctions, it was in relation to a story about toxic dumping by a company called Trafigura. This time the issue isn't exactly of international importance.
No, but of course one of intense interest for Fleet Street newspapers. And we must remember now that this is the second super injunction that's fallen over, but there are many, many more out there that we don't know about and can't tell you about, and couldn't tell you about even if we knew. So I think we've got to, if we are trying to, some people are trying to build a case that the age of the super injunction is passing, but I don't necessarily think that's the case. And I think that Justin Tugendhat was very specific in his reasons for rejecting this super injunction as being inappropriate. And in future cases, they might not be so.
What were the reasons specifically in this case for
Well, I think that the judge decided that he didn't like the way Shillings had presented the case involving Terry to him. And he thought that there are the fact that the newspaper group in question, News Group Newspapers, didn't know that the super injunction was on its way and hadn't been contacted was a point that he mentioned. He was also quoted talking about what freedoms we have. And he says, yes, everyone has got a freedom to live as they choose, but and that was a valuable principle. But then the justice said, so is freedom to criticise within the limits of the law the conduct of other members of society as being socially harmful or wrong.
That's very interesting, and we'll come on to that in a moment. But Jane, do you think that there is a change in the air about the attitude towards super injunctions in particular and the libel laws in general?
Well, of course, I mean, we all hope so around this table as journalists. And Justice Tugendhat has sort of come out with something which seems to have changed the atmosphere around these sorts of all-encompassing injunctions, and indeed the suggestion that elements of somebody's private life should remain private. And we'll come along to the story that's come up today. I think in terms of the press, where the judgment is interesting and has caused some sort of reason to believe there is a change in the air, is this suggestion that if you are putting in this injunction in order to safeguard your business interests. And, I mean, obviously, John Terry has used his perfect family life, the fact that he was voted Daddy of the Year by Daddy Source. Hmm. He has very lucrative marketing contracts. He is, you know, a role model for children at a time we're in the World Cup year. The captain of the English football team. I mean, I was actually one who, at the time of Tiger Woods, argued that brands like Omega and all these sort of brands that were focused on men, young men, really didn't mind that he had this reputation for affairs. And actually, I was proved wrong. I mean, they did mind. He lost a lot of money. You know, he's now in a sort of difficult place, and not just because of his private life, but because his business has imploded around him. Well, actually, that's a valid reason to say, if you are being held up as this sort of person, the public, and via the means of the press, have a right to find out whether that's true or not.
And I think the judge also seemed to indicate in his comments that he didn't quite believed that Terry's defence was all about his private life. And he came out and said, actually, this is also to do with you attempting to safeguard your business interests.
Now, obviously, John Terry has been all over the tabloid and some of the broadsheet front pages this week. Do you get a sense, Stephen, that you know there's a bit of a tabloid pack hunting going on? They are trying to get him out, and they sense that he's vulnerable, and they're sensing blood here.
I think they think it's a good story. I don't necessarily think they want him to leave the captaincy of the England football team. It seems to be that the man who's going to make the crucial decision on that is Fabio Capello.
Yes.
So you've got some columnists saying doesn't matter. You've got other columnists saying he's a stinker, has to go. The FA, though, seems to have equivocated. The teammates, both at Chelsea and in the England squad, don't seem to be calling for his head.
Jane, it was very easy in the Trafficura case to make the case against super injunctions because of what Trafficura were doing. Do you think it's a bit harder for proponents of reform of libel law to use John Terry as a cause around which to wrap the flag, so to speak?
Harder simply because what the advocates of privacy, which slightly ludicrously their flag bearer is now Max Mosley, say is, you know, to have a private life, if there is a story saying famous Premiership footballer caught having an affair with colleague's wife, you know, the game is then on to spot which one it is. Therefore, a super injunction has the benefit of making that sort of rumour go away. The problem is, because super injunctions are so all-encompassing, firms like Shillings, and Shillings have actually sort of been at the forefront of doing this, are sort of going out to
them
do them willy-nilly.
Yes.
I mean, it's a slightly poor use of words, but I mean, you know, they are
no, but
doing
they
it
do
all...
advertise themselves as this is their specialism. If you want your reputation protected, come to us.
And given the cost of stopping that from happening, anything that says, hang on, if you are going to do this sort of all-encompassing block on any sort of comment, any sort of report, there must be an absolutely cast iron reason. You know, frankly, given that we have injunctions, given the state of the law, the need for a super injunction seems to me to be a moot point anyway. So I don't think it should be any different with John.
And don't forget that whilst super injunctions are under attack, there are a whole other array of legal techniques that can be used by famous people to stop stories getting out. And that this all goes back to the man who found out that his wife was having it off with a footballer and sold the story to a newspaper, but the footballer injuncted that story, and to this day it still cannot be reported.
Well, yeah, but because there are competing privacy issues between the three people, aren't there? So privacy law was used to keep that under wraps.
Yes.
Now, by a happy coincidence, the whole issue of the restrictions placed upon the press were discussed at a high-powered seminar at Gray's Inn Chambers in London this week, with senior law figures, editors, and the former Formula One boss Max Mosley in attendance. The event began with a challenge from Sir Ken McDonald, the former Director of Public Prosecutions, who raised an upcoming court case involving the science writer Simon Singh, who is being sued in London by the Canadian Association of Chiropractors. Sir Ken called for a complete overhaul of libel law.
Perhaps the court will say that our law should be nurturing the free exchange of ideas, it should be protecting research and science, it shouldn't encourage corporate bullying, it should allow free and autonomous people to be thoroughly offensive to each other, and it certainly shouldn't have any role in shielding chancers and charlatans. And above all, our law should not associate our country with the suppression of free comment or the stifling of information so that it dies before it can pass around the world.
Sir Ken MacDonald. Now, the Guardian editor, Alan Rusbridger, agreed that the practice of libel tourism had become a matter of shame for the English legal system.
And I think it just feels wrong that dodgy Russians and Ukrainians should be flooding... Is that libelous? Yes, it is. Should be flooding to London to take advantage of our laws. And it's slightly shaming when American jurisdictions start refusing to implement the laws of UK. It's embarrassing when you get papers like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, which are really good, solid, responsible papers, being humbled in British courts for journalism, which would have never been able to be attacked in the USA.
Max Mosley, the ex-Formula One boss whose sexual proclivities came to the attention of the News of the World, raised the case of John Terry, which we've just been speaking about, and expressed the view that the press were allowed to print far too much about people's private lives.
I cannot exaggerate the effect that these invasions have on people. And really, when this is weighed up, so often in the other side, there is no real public interest. Because even if you take recent cases like, for example, John Terry, there is, I would say, very clearly people are interested because he's a footballer, but do the public need to know whether he's had an affair? Is that something that the public need to know? That it's not the public who make a decision about Mr. Terry, whether he should be the captain or whether he should play for England. It's the team manager. It's fun to talk about it in the pub, but it's not something that the people need to talk to about in the pub. So should his family and his wife and all these people be put through this misery just so people can have the fun of discussing it?
Sir Ken MacDonald supported the view that the press had gone too far, and he said that any liberalisation of the law should be accompanied by tighter regulation of the press.
One of the reasons the public are not more exercised about these issues than they should be is probably because the press have long behaved so badly that nobody cares if their expression is restricted. And Richard Desmond's vile attacks on the McCanns is just one example. But this public cynicism is very dangerous. It devalues something in everybody, and it creates a climate in which repression of free speech becomes too easy.
Sir Ken MacDonald, the former Director of Public Prosecutions, and the full debate, Gagging the Press, which was held at Gray's Inn Chambers this week, is available on mediaguardian.co.uk as a Media Talk Extra. Well, just to wrap up the session, we've been talking about privacy in the case of John Terry, but libel reform is sort of tangentially kind of wrapped up in with this again. You're returning to this issue in Media Guardian in the coming weeks, and the government has said, hasn't it, that it does intend to look at libel laws and whether Britain has too, or England specifically, has too restrictive a system.
We're expecting in the next few weeks, by the middle of sort of February or a bit later, John Whittingdale's Select Committee to come out with this report into this issue. And most lawyers you talk to expect there to be sort of giving on one hand, taking away on the other in terms of what the press want and what lawyers want. Because on the one hand, and this is where the issue of privacy and libel reform obviously do interact. On the one hand, you know, the issue of the prohibitive cost of libel actions, the issue of the sort of growth of the super injunction, and the sort of balance that has tipped too far the way of the claimant against the defendant in the press has completely sort of affecting the press's ability to report properly, weighed against the right of the individual to privacy, to actually before anything. And, you know, there are issues where people are being accused with sort of rumour and innuendo, and their reputations are being irreparably damaged, and actually it's not, may not even be true. So I think that report will be interesting, and the sort of legal profession is divided in terms of, you know, how that's going to actually play out.
Okay, well, we'll obviously be returning to this in the future. Keep up to date with the latest developments on mediaguardian.co.uk, where we'll also have more from that seminar we were hearing from a few minutes ago in the next few days.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
Coming up, more developments in the tabloid phone hacking saga. But first, the eagerly awaited radio listening figures are out. I went down into the bustling Media Guardian newsroom to seek out our radio correspondent, John Plunkett, to give us the details.
Well, we're all waiting for the great digital leap forward, but in the last 3 months of 2009, according to the latest figures, digital radio listening actually went down from 21.1% to 20.9%. Now, as you know, as we lead up towards digital switchover, if when it happens, this digital listening figure needs to get to 50% before that two-year process can kick in. And far from actually getting towards 50%, we're actually backing away from it. It's particularly bad timing for the radio industry because right now the Digital Economy Bill is going through Parliament, and part of that includes a digital switchover plan, possibly as early as 2015. But as everyone queues up to convince everyone from manufacturers to consumers to MPs to retailers that digital radio is the sort of happening thing and it's the next big gadget, in fact, listening is going down.
A bit disappointing there, but very good news for, bizarrely, for Terry Wogan.
Terry Wogan, he went out on a stormer, yes. He said goodbye to his breakfast show last month, and he equaled his best ever audience of 8.1 million listeners, which is great news for Sir Terry, but not quite so good news for Chris Evans, because he's got an even bigger mountain to climb if he's going to hang on to all those listeners and potentially add a few more.
Pretty inevitable that he's going to see a downturn, isn't he? And then you can imagine what the tabloid stories will be at that time.
He will go down, yes. Talk's dessert, Radio 2 breakfast show, uproar scandal. And I guess one of the things we'll look at is Wogan had an 860,000 lead over Chris Moyles at Radio 1. So is that a big enough cushion for Evans to stay number one? Or will Moyles finally get his dream before he one day exits the Radio 1 job and become the biggest breakfast show in the UK?
Stay tuned for the next quarter, Rachel.
Out to you in May, so not long to wait, yeah.
There's been some interesting developments in the London tussle, which is always fascinating.
There has, yeah. Two big things to look out for this time around. One was that Magic, which has been number one in terms of number of listeners for nearly 3 years, was toppled not only by Heart, but also by Capital. So two global radio stations are number one and two in the market.
Magic has lost its dazzle.
It has lost its dazzle, sparkle. But Magic pulled a rabbit out of the hat by staying number one in terms of market share, which depends on how long people actually listen to the station. But number two in terms of market share is LBC, which had a fantastic radar, thanks to a good performance by its breakfast host, Nick Ferrari. So in terms of the number of hours and market share, it's now the second most popular station in London. And as far as I can tell, that's not happened since there were two stations in London. So it's a very good performance by LBC.
It could, of course, be down to Stephen Brooks' regular appearances on the Andrew Pearce show at weekends.
I have no doubt that that has a big... And Stephen's a big listener and has his own radar diary, so I think that had a massive impact, yes.
Is John Plunkett there? Is this true, Brookie, that you've got your own radar diary?
I would have thought a bigger impact on the listening figures was the ending of your LBC show, Matt.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that was a long time ago now. Anyway, for full details of the radio listening figures can be found at mediaguardian.co.uk. Let's take a look at some of the other top media news stories of the week. There have been more developments in the News of the World phone hacking story, haven't there, Stephen?
Yes, there's been two developments. One is that there's been court action that has been taken by celebrity agent Max Clifford, who is no friend of the News of the World, as we well know. And he's been mentioned in dispatches when the original phone hacking case took place that saw the royal editor of the paper sent to jail and one of the investigators that they also used sent to jail. He has been trying to get hold of documents that were involved in that case and also part of the police investigation into the whole incident. And this week a judge has ruled that he should have access to those documents because he may well want to mount a case that his phones were hacked illegally, as did Gordon Taylor from the Professional Footballers Association, which led to that £1 million payout.
Well, Max Clifford has been busy this week because, of course, he was acting for the former girlfriend of John Terry as well, isn't he?
And, yes, yes. Yeah. And on the other side of the coin, John Terry's agent was, of course, former News of the World editor Phil Hall.
Really, really? I didn't know that. That's good knowledge. It's all part of a...
News of the World, they're everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
They show how much money can be made from going into PR.
Clearly, as I've said on many occasions, we are in the wrong jobs.
No, you don't really.
There was the other development was another report by Nick Davis in The Guardian, wasn't it, about the...
He has been digging around with the mobile phone companies who have now confirmed, three phone companies have come forward and said that a large number of people who had accounts with them, numbering probably around the range of 100, did have their phones hacked by the numbers that were used by both Goodman and Mulcaire. And Nick Davies is saying that this is a much higher number than the police or the paper has previously admitted to. It's all in the mix as we await the Select Committee report onto the phone hacking. And it looks like things were dying down because News International Chief Executive Rebecca Brooks was not going to be giving verbal evidence to that committee. And their report has been off delayed. We wait to see whether these latest stories have any impact on it or not.
In politics land, the Tories seem to be gunning for the BBC Trust, don't they, Jane?
Yeah, I mean, they've been gunning for them for some time, but they keep sort of, they get the guns out, they put them away again, they're not really quite sure what they actually want, then they get them back
Can't
out
find
again.
The guns.
I mean, you know, some people argue there was a huge, the Times decided to make it the splash, a leader and a double page spread
on
the fact that they wanted to get rid of Michael Lyons and also change the trust and change it in two really interesting ways for sad wonks such as myself that finds this really interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, saying that putting in a non-exec chairman onto the BBC executive body,
yeah.
And having so sort of splitting the role, so you get the champion on the board, and then you get the trust itself changing its name.
Wait for it. What's the new name for the BBC Trust?
License Fee Payers Trust.
It's Trust.
No, but actually, the really interesting thing, as sad as it is that, of course, what that means is a return of the old Terry Burns, John Burt, off beep. But not beep, because what that could mean is License Fee Payers Trust that could give that money to whichever media company, whether it's down in Wapping or based in White City, wants the money for public service broadcasting.
It paves the way for top slicing, doesn't it? And this organisation, stripped of the name BBC, becomes the body that develops it. It does make sense, that bit aside. It makes complete sense for there to be a non-executive chairman on the board of the BBC, because at the moment, all power is concentrated in one man, Mark Thompson, and that can't be right.
I mean, I've talked to Michael Lyons this week for Monday's section. He's practically now the last man standing, actually supporting the BBC Trust, him and the other trustees. But what he had said is that in the years of arguments, as we all remember, running up to the last charter renewal and this compromise agreement, the problem was found, in the wake of Hutton, that when something happened that was sort of terrible and the chairman stepped forward to defend the BBC, they were then seen as how outrageous it was that they were then supposed to be the ones saying, no, whether this was right or wrong. Hmm. So they tried to sort of separate out those two things. If you don't have a body with the power of a license fee payers group as opposed to Ofcom, then you can't get this sense of having non-political, non-interference. I mean, this is a hoary subject that has been going on and on and on. No, even Patricia Hodgson at the session that we attended in Oxford said,
Patricia Hodgson, who was, of course, a BBC trustee, she was speaking at the Oxford Media Convention.
The worst possible option is the BBC Trust as is, except for all the other options.
Yeah.
I mean,
the dilemma, because this issue is talked about, once every month on this programme. It comes around again and again and again, and there have been so many different iterations. Governors, trust, Ofcom gets a bit of regulation, Ofcom wants a bit more, and top slicing, it's the same thing, always comes up. Tories have been making so much noise, not just this week in The Times, but for months now, about how they would like to change things.
Although some people see this is a step back for the Tories, that actually they've been saying, let's get rid of it altogether. Now they're trying to come up with something.
When they get into government, it is a lot more difficult to meddle with the BBC than it is to make pronouncements from opposition.
And there's so much else going on that they're going to be bothered with anyway. Meanwhile, the National Audit Office has criticised the BBC for spending, £250,000 on studios for Euro 2008 in order to make sure that they had a nice picture of Vienna in the background.
But I'm really interested in the whole... I live in Greenwich, so I'm going to give my thing. But, one of the really interesting
things...
You're going
to rent out your house when the Olympics are on to the BBC,
Jane. No, I love
a backdrop of the Olympic Stadium. Is that right?
Actually,
Jane Martinson's house is going
reason,
to be...
The main reason that it is in Greenwich, and it's costing... the sort of local dissent is mounting. The main reason it's there is because of the pictures.
The BBC said the studio is going to be in Greenwich, is that right?
All the sort of, the whole Olympic, when you use the sort of the Olympic Games and the way the BBC will present it, lovely picture of, the observatory and the hill and the river. Yeah. I mean, it's a fabulously photogenic, but you sort of get the sense with this, the Euro 2008, that this is an ongoing thing.
Mm.
Cost is no problem when the pictures are involved.
No, absolutely.
If only that were the case for us.
Yes, we have our lovely backdrop. I'm just turning around there to see the T-point is what the background is in our studios.
I can see some very prominent Guardian executives.
Oh yes, you have a different view from me.
Judging by their hand gesticulation, there's some important meeting going on. I can't name names.
They're probably deciding our futures as we speak, Brookie. So
I cannot name names, but I can see Janine Gibson scribbling on a pad.
Yes, that's right. The producer's just been told to pull the plug. Right. Listen, thank you very much for that. You can find more on all these stories at mediaguardian.co.uk.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
That's just about it for this week's Media Talk. Thank you very much to both our panellists. Well, obviously, Jane, you're a mover and shaker, clearly. You came hotfoot to us from a top showbiz lunch, I understand. But what have you been finding out this week? Have you gleaned anything from your movements?
One of the things I've been really interested in is the whole sort of UK Film Council and what's been going on there with their sort of, you know, possibly merging with the BFI, which again, you know, brings in our old friend Greg Dyke.
Oh, yes, could, yes.
Because he's head of the BFI and he's on the board of the Film Council.
Yeah, and there's a proposal to merge them, or
well,
rumours.
It doesn't really seem like it's going to happen before the election, because, you know, why would they? But that's, you know, there's quite a significant slug of money being spent on UK films that be quite interesting to see what the Tories do with it.
Stephen, what have you been up to?
Well, I haven't been up to anything, but I have learnt that I've been hitting the phones, you know, trying to bust some stories. What I've learnt this week, that it's a very good time to be a woman at News International. Chief Executive Rebecca Brooks had a dinner for some select female executives this week, and it's all part of a grand plan to create a global women's network at News Corp.
That's good information.
Story.
It's being masterminded by Rebecca Brooks, who is a woman, and James Murdoch, who isn't.
Well, she's, and about time too.
Well,
that's
interestingly,
marvellous.
She is going, her next, one of her rare public outings, her next speech is going to be at a, is it Women in Journalism? Certainly a women's networking event.
Yeah. Join the dots, Matt. The dots.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you very much. This is what we pay you for, Stephen. How will we manage when you've gone? I don't
Stop.
Know.
Stop. Don't talk about it.
Oh, I know, it's just too painful. Thank you very much, Stephen Brooke and Jane Martinson. I'm Matt Wells. The producer was Pascal Wise. That's Media Talk for another week. Goodbye.